know you wanted to be a writer or were a writer?
Well, I think a lot of people assume that writers are born, you know, certainly in kindergarten, if not before. But I think I was one of those who assumed that all those books on the shelves of the library had been put there by God. weren't real people that were involved in the making of them. So I didn't start writing until I was in my 30s. I experimented with fiction just after I finished my master's degree. So I would have been 32. But I had small kids. And it took a while for them to free up enough hours of the week for me to focus a little more closely on what I was doing. Yeah. So I started writing seriously when I was about 35, and just kept writing. Finished one book, wrote a second book, started a third one. By the time I was into my third one, the first one had sold. So I was then a part of the industry.
It's fascinating to us that how many writers, professional writers we've spoken with, who really didn't begin until they were into their adulthood. And I'm not sure there's anything to be drawn from that, but it's sort of, I always thought that James Michener was the only one who did that. And I'm discovering almost most good writers started late.
Partly it has to do with whether or not you've taken training in writing. And I think an awful lot of us, especially in genre fiction, come to it as adults because we are doing our training in writing for the first 20, 25 years of our life. That is, we read.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time for you to feel that you know how to tell a story. And that's how it was with me, that I had to hit 35 before I thought, maybe I can do this. And so...
But what about storytelling? Were you, as a kid, a storyteller or fantasizer, daydreamer?
Well, yeah, I mean, of course. I'm a Californian,
that's
who isn't?
Right. Silver-tongued devils,
yeah,
we
yeah,
be.
Yeah. We live in another planet most of the time. Yeah, I think I was... I mean, I spent my childhood reading fiction. And so that was my community, was books in the library. When I played with friends, they were generally fictional friends. Partly because we moved so much.
And you grew up where?
Partly Bay Area, California. I lived for a while up in Puget Sound, up in the Puget Sound area.
Yeah.
And back and forth. So, when you move every year, it's not really worth the effort of making friends after a while. You just...
But your imaginary ones go with you wherever you go.
Yeah, much easier.
Right, carry them in your back pocket.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, your first byline. Do you remember seeing your first byline?
On a book?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Other than a master's thesis.
No.
Sure. To actually get the first copy of Grave Talent was, it was really a great feeling.
That's real. No doubt.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I mean, there's nothing, nothing like a physical book. And I think a lot of people who experiment with e-books, it's fine. Your stories are out there and the income flow is there, but it's not the same, really not the same.
It's to actually hold it and smell it.
Yeah.
Did you do anything special when you signed a contract or got your first royalty check or whatever? Did you and your husband go out to dinner or were you just...
Well, my first royalty check, we lived in an old farmhouse, and the heating that we'd had in the house was a wood stove. So my first, my celebration for a royalty check was actually based on one of the international checks, which in the early days were more than the U.S. ones.
Uh-huh.
was to buy central heating.
How prosaic.
Just turn a switch. Oh, it was so lovely. It really was. You didn't have to fiddle with, you know, wood and ashes and, you know, all the rest of it. It just was there. It was lovely. That's why I became a writer. Central heating.
Could you tell us your habits about writing? I mean, every writer seems to have superstitious behaviors or set schedules or things they do about their writing. Do you have any?
No.
Yep, you just write.
You know, there's so many disadvantages to self-employment that I kind of figure the advantages of doing your work when you want to, take it while you can.
Perfect.
But yeah, I happen to be a really fast writer, so my first drafts, it only takes me 2 or 3 months to do a first draft.
Ah.
And then longer for the rewrite. I tend to do a very rough first draft, and the rewrites take 4 or 5 months. But that means that I tend to sort of go all out. I'm working. I used to work huge days, and now I think I'm a little more efficient, so... I don't write quite so many hours in the day.
And do you write longhand or type?
Again,
it out,
I used to write longhand. My first 7 or 8 books were written with a Waterman fountain pen.
Really?
On pads. And I found that it was physically a very easy way to write because, you know, a good fountain pen, you're not holding it, you're not grasping it, you're not pushing, it's just there.
Yeah.
So I didn't get any of the wrist things that people tend to do when they're using a typewriter.
Yeah.
When laptops got small enough that I could actually sit with it in my lap in the way that I had with the pen, I could make the transfer into the computer age.
Do you have a favorite chair or corner?
I have a study, yeah. And where I generally write is there's a day bed, so I'm sitting, you know, with my feet up on a oversized clipboard on my lap, and the laptop on top of it. I write with I think it's an 11.5 inch Mac Air at the moment.
Ah, they're nice
small.
Little light ones. So you transitioned into using your laptop now.
Yeah.
And so your first drafts are run on the computer.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to write pretty much everything now. It took me a long time before I could compose on a computer. For a long time, I would, even letters, I tended to compose and then transfer. But
right.
My brain has now come into the 21st century, and it's unconscious now.
Have you moved up to the iPads yet?
I have an iPad, but it's lousy for writing.
Uh-huh.
They're just not...
Yeah.
You know, they're fine for playing. But.
Yeah. And no doubt you use for research as well.
It's amazing how the Internet has developed just in the last 5 or 10 years with... You know, even 10 years ago, research online was not really possible.
Mm-hmm.
It was most useful for tracking someone down,
right,
who has a museum in something, or to hunt down a book that you wanted.
Right.
But now, and especially with so many of the old and out of print books being scanned and being online, there's a lot of research you can actually do online. I mean, there are problems, and weeding out the garbage is always tough.
Right.
But there's a lot available now.
Yeah.
I'm working on a book that's set in Morocco in 1924.
Ooh.
And there's quite a bit of film available from the French film company called Pathé, the camera,
mm-hmm,
and they have a whole archive of news films, you know, 5-minute news films, mm-hmm, of Maréchal Leoté in Morocco, and the Reef Rebellion that's taking place, and you know, I mean, just hugely useful for someone like me.
Yeah,
it's just a fabulous country.
Yeah,
so. Huh. We went there. I spent the spring a year ago in Lisbon with my daughter and her husband, and we decided to go off someplace, and we sort of looked to where we could get a plane flight that didn't involve a change.
Right.
And pretty much every place to the east you have to change in Madrid.
Yeah.
But Morocco, we could get a simple one-way to Casablanca.
Oh, I've seen that, of course, in the movie. It has
the map with the little plane that goes
to Casablanca
well,
from
Madrid. Well, that was us. That's with the little curving line down to, yeah. So we went there, and I used it in the last book, Pirate King. But that was just one city, and it really wasn't enough. So when they said, "Don't you want to do another Russell?" I said, "Okay."
Yeah.
Because I just so wanted to set a book in Fez.
Ooh,
Fez is
just
the most,
a name.
Yeah. I mean, it's the most incredible city.
Yeah. So I have to ask off the record, why is a fez called a fez?
Well, they're made in there.
Because that's where they're made.
Yeah, they were originally made there, and they are dyed. I mean, the original fez was red.
Right.
And they're dyed from a local berry,
apparently. Ah. Huh.
Yeah.
Okay, we can go home now, Sally. I've got all my answers. I know where Charlie is buried, and I know why fezzes are called fezzes. There's no more left in life.
No, there are no mysteries left.
That's great. So, Lori, if you wouldn't mind, I know that you've spoken to young writers and writing groups. What advice do you have for writers who are starting up or hoping to become a writer? Or?
Well, it's interesting because at the moment I am working fairly flat out on a how-to book. A friend and I are writing crime fiction book.
Ooh.
And it boils down to be a writer, read and write. You know, the rest of it comes. That if you talk to new and young writers, it's amazing how often you find that they've written something, and then they have this book, and it's this treasure, and it's their newborn baby, and they need to do something with it, so they keep working on it, and then they try and sell it, and they don't sort of look past it to say, a writer is not a person with a book. A writer is a person who writes. I tend to write really lousy first drafts.
Mm-hmm.
They're just bad. But I write. And you know, once I have it, I can improve it.
Yeah.
If I don't have it, there's nothing to improve.
I have to ask, you have some memorable characters. Do your characters talk to you? I mean, I don't mean to suggest that you're schizophrenic or anything of the sort, but do your characters
ever... Not diagnosed, anyway.
Yeah, do your characters lead any of the drama, or are you always in control of them like puppets?
Or? Well, I am dependent on the characters to take over.
Hmm.
This book that Michelle Spring and I are working on is very interesting because she is what we've decided to call orderly. That is, she writes to an outline. And I am what we have decided to call organic, meaning...
Disorderly.
Chaotic, yes.
Chaotic.
That I tend to have a fairly clear idea of where the book is set, what the main concerns are, who the people are, and what direction it's going in, the sort of flavor of it. But if I had to do an outline, I wouldn't bother doing the book. I just wouldn't. And this is incomprehensible to someone who depends on the outline process. So it's actually going to be quite an interesting book because we have nothing nothing in common in our writing styles, and yet we
yet
both
you're
write novels.
Collaborate on a book. That's great.
So that when I start a book, I'm really following the characters. In the back of my mind, there's something that keeps track of it, and this is what someone who uses a physical outline, whether it's an outline form or whether it's a tree diagram or, you know, what do they call it, a brain map?
Right.
Doesn't understand is that to someone who works the way I do, there is an organizing principle back there, but I don't need to put it on the paper.
Right.
If I did, I wouldn't bother actually writing the book because it's there, and I've told myself the story, and why bother?
I was curious, how did you come to write with Sherlock Holmes?
Well, I was writing about a young woman who has that mind. You know, Mary Russell is a young female feminist, 20th century Sherlock Holmes. And I thought that it was interesting to look at how that mind would function in a different setting. You know, instead of being a 19th century upper class male, to just take that way of looking at the world and put it in someone else. And that's where the book started, the idea of what would Sherlock Holmes look like if he were a young woman. And I think putting the two of them next to each other is the interesting part. I think a lot of the readers wish that they would be together for more of the books than they are. But they are Russell stories rather than Holmes stories.
Yeah.
But it's turned out to be interesting because I pick up Holmes when Conan Doyle is finished with him in 1915. Mm-hmm. Conan Doyle finishes with him at the eve, literally the eve of the Great War in 1914. And Russell and he meet the following spring. And to be allowed to take a character who is already fully formed, mm-hmm. and yet to allow him to develop as a person was very interesting. It is very interesting. Because as far as Conan Doyle was concerned, there was no place for Holmes in the England that existed after the Great War. That the huge social changes that took place, the social changes, the economic changes, the scientific changes, everything in Britain turned 90 degrees. And Conan Doyle just couldn't envision his creation there anymore. And looking at him, I thought, no, I can see him doing some very interesting things mm-hmm. post-war. I think I have more respect for the character in some ways than Conan Doyle did. Conan Doyle never could understand why people so adored Sherlock Holmes. He found it immensely frustrating because people wanted to hear about Holmes instead of his important fiction, which was the historical stuff, the White Company, and unreadable. really unreadable. But he never could quite summon up an awful lot of respect for his detective character.
Well, you've certainly fleshed him out in a different way, and that's very appealing. It's a hard one to handle.
And I think that, I mean, going by the reaction of the devout Sherlockians, I seem to have found a reasonable alternate history that, if Holmes had gone on after the war, he would have looked something like that, which is nice when the people who actually know what they're talking about agree with you.
You've mentioned early on about the growth of e-books and, mm-hmm. and then now the growth of technology and its impact on the old Sherlock Holmes. Mm-hmm. Do you see, have any idea of what the future of writing in America might be given the changes in technology and the culture and the advent of Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff? Do you think it's going to change?
Well, it's tough to know. I mean, on the surface, it would look as though our attention span is getting shorter and shorter. However, if you look at the bestseller lists, there's plenty of room on there for George R. R. Martin and his, you know, and Stephen King, and I mean, things that I have problems with them because I'm looking at them, and that's a month's commitment of reading at my current rate. And I think, is that all? Can I read that or three other books?
Or 200,000 haikus.
So, but I think that the current fascination for self-published e-books is in the shakedown process. I think that the probability of people catching on and actually making a living off of self-published e-books is diminishing. I think as an adjunct to other publishing, it can be very valuable. I know a number of writers who their early stuff is no longer in print, and it's so good to be able to say to people, you can get all of those books online now.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of writers that I adore, and they're very difficult to find.
Yeah.
And once it's up an ebook, and once it's formatted in there, you don't have warehousing problems, you don't have... You know. So, as far as that is concerned, you know, if I had any books that were not in print, I would not hesitate to put them on, you know, available online. But it's a very valuable tool. And I think that although the publishing industry has taken a while to really get its head around this idea of e-publishing, there's some really bright people in publishing, and they're figuring it out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Every year, the numbers of the relationship between a hardback and an ebook just shift madly.
Right.
I'm relatively unusual in that I have probably as many people buy hardbacks as they do ebooks,
uh-huh.
which is for crime fiction unusual.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think that I have a lot of committed fans in the English sense that they should be locked up. committed fans who like to read books over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice to have a physical book if you're going to do that. It's
right.
nice to have that physical connection.
Right.
And I know a lot of people, this last time when I went on tour, a lot of people buying a hardback 3 days into the tour had already read it as an ebook. They were happy to have both formats.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, there's a thing that's just coming out is a way of getting bookstores to actually sell an ebook. It's a little folder that has a card in it with a code on it that you buy at the bookstore and then take home and download it. And it means that you have a physical object, a very attractive folder, and you've supported your bookstore.
Clever.
This is a thing that I saw at a conference 2 months
Any
ago.
Any book where? That you've read over and over again?
I think there's probably any number of Peter Dickinson's that I've read several times. And again, Josephine Tay, Dorothy Sayers, a lot of her stuff. I'm not much of an Agatha Christie person. I just, you know, whodunits. I read for the characters, and Christie was not really that interested in those.
Were there people that you read when you were young that helped shape?
I don't think I read a lot of crime fiction when I was young. I think I read mostly science fiction. I don't think I started reading mysteries until I was in my 30s.
So you read them and just went right at it in your 30s.
Well,
that's wonderful.
I think that looking back, one of the reasons that I liked mysteries was that you have a format for telling a story there that's fairly clear-cut. And unlike science fiction, which can just sort of go anywhere, or even mainstream fiction, doesn't really have the kind of skeleton that mysteries do. That as a vehicle for telling stories that matter, I found crime fiction really suited me quite well.
I really want to thank you for this both last minute 11th hour request and getting the chance to meet you and hear some of these stories. It's just wonderful.
Well, I'm glad you could manage to get here at the same time I was.
This is synchronicity. Thank you so much.
Certainly.